this, on section six, would section six expand individual criminal liability?
Is he, can he be, can he be?
Well, let's say, for example, a corporation is supposed to file an annual report, whatever, and the president says, oh, that, what's the sale, too much to do, it's not bothering this year. But the specific statute governing corporation says it's a misdemeanor for a corporation to file an annual report. Now, can they take this section six and indict the president?
It's his duty to sign it.
In the absence of language in the corporation code, which said, in other words, if the corporation code didn't say, didn't purport to affix misdemeanor liability to anybody but the corporate entity, could you use section six and indict the president?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
What does the section six serve?
Well, it serves this, that it doesn't give an individual who's has on his own, always acting presumably on behalf of the corporation, from criminal liability by saying that he can pass the buck and say, well, I can't be guilty in my own right because the corporation, because of respondeat superior, is the guilty party.
Aren't most of those statutes that deal with corporations? I mean, it's the same thing as principal and agent. You can always hold the agent.
For what he did.
Yeah.
If the statute says you can.
What?
If he goes out and steals $1 million to put in the corporation's coffers,
he's guilty of that.
Yeah. He's guilty of theft because he did it.
That's because the theft statute says
any person.
Any person who steals
the money. That's what most of them are defined. It seemed to me we might be catching somebody here that the legislature and the party that comes from is intended to. I just wonder why we need this statute.
The legislature overlooked it.
What if there are corporate crimes are defined in terms of any person? Any trust laws, this type of thing. And they often sue both the corporation and the officers.
Yeah, well.
What if there's a failure to file something on time?
I'm not so certain. I think that is a decision that should be made at the time for that statute, whether you want to hold the officer.
Well, you just said what type of things that he'd be responsible anyway. Who would be in that case?
Well,
the statute says that corporations shall file certain things on a certain date. If not,
the president's got to do it.
No, it just says a corporation. Who would be responsible then?
I can see the president, secretary, and the court. Did my job, his job. Well, what we talked about in the subcommittee, when we were the example was used, even though the numbers got transposed some on them, is the case here a while ago, a couple of years ago, where Greyhound bus started from Portland for San Francisco and skidded on some ice the side of Medford and turned over and killed and injured a number of people. Yeah, 38 people on it got hurt, 13 of them got killed or something. It was quite an accident. But the Greyhound company says it isn't their fault if the driver drives toward Alice. The driver says, we're not really expected to keep up with the timetable. The timetable requires them to drive well past, you know, to make 70 miles an hour from the Portland city limits to the Medford city limits to make that schedule.
Leave the driving to us.
And as far as that case doesn't make sense to me, because the driver is either liable or he isn't. The fact that Greyhound's bus timetable isn't going to be any offense for him. He's under the same standard as...
But that's not what we're talking about, is it?
No.
We're talking about if the corporation fixed his schedule so that by God he had to violate the law, he's guilty of violating the law, but so is the corporation.
We want it. Well, wait a minute, six. But six is talking about the driver, not the corporation.
Well, that's right.
That's 2 and 6.
I'm not sure we're talking about section 5 or section 6. I just wonder why it seems to me if we don't need it. It's surplusage.
Well, we make it, by having it, we make it clear that he can't claim the corporation and thereby induce some weak-kneed judge to let him out.
Well,
because the statute clearly
says... I think in 6 we're also referring not only to the driver, but the guy who drew up the schedule.
Yeah.
Caused it to be performed in the name of and behalf of the corporation.
Lee, this is one of those where out of an overabundance of caution, we want to be sure to cover them.
I buy that.
I don't think this is going to hurt corporations or the individual too much anyway.
No. My point is it's surplusage. I don't see what the need is. That's all I can say.
No, I don't think it is.
Well, as I read it, all it says is that if there's a statute that says corporations have to file reports by the 1st of July or they'll get fined $500, that if the statute goes on to say, and the president of the corporation is also subject to a similar fine if he permits or allows the corporation not to file, that that's okay, but that if the statute merely says corporations who don't file by July 1st will be fined $500, that's the only one you can try is the corporation. But that if the statute says you can try either the corporation or the president or both, this statute, this principle would say, okay, that's fine, you can try them both.
And the that's president one goes further than that. I think it goes further than that. If the statute says that the speed limits on the highway shall be so-called basic rule, unless they're posted differently, and this freeway is posted at 60 miles an hour from Portland to Salem, and the bus schedule won't meet it at less than 70, and I think that that's
the guy that okays the schedule.
The guy that draws up requires the driver to meet the schedule is, in my opinion, equally subject to penalty anyway as the driver who goes down the thing and gets picked up as he goes by Eugene in a cloud of dust.
Which I think he would be liable for.
He ain't in there, remember.
He'd be liable anyway.
In that case, it would be being criminally liable for the conduct of another under that statute we just discussed.
That's
I got to think about the button.
Well, his conduct constitutes an offense. Is that the same conduct that we're talking about when we were saying the last night, if such conduct? I was thinking of a CPA who filed a corporate state income tax and was furnished false information, and it was a false report, but he didn't have knowledge that the information was false. Would he be liable for this conduct constituting an offense, which would be the corporate conduct in furnishing the false information, to the same extent as if such conduct performed in his own name?
I'd say he wouldn't.
No,
this
shouldn't.
This is what bugs me about this section, is whether it doesn't enhance some liability on individuals that we don't cover. I think the purpose of the statute is not, the purpose is already covered. I'm just wondering whether it doesn't get this account.
All this says is criminally liable for certain conduct if it constitutes an offense. If he performs it, if he performs that conduct, or if he causes it to be performed in the name of or in behalf of the corporation, it's criminal conduct. He's doing this or having it done in the name of the corporation. Then in that situation, that conduct itself must be criminal. And he does not escape responsibility simply by saying that he acted in behalf of the corporation. And I think that's all this thing amounts to.
It's a closer case of an old concept. What you're saying is speaking for itself. We're so used to the concept that I'm not used to say it again, but we are defining our concepts of criminal law in this whole section.
It's exactly what the.
I'll go along with it.
Okay, we move along.
I know we buy the whole works except that stuff that you see. That's the one we've got to say.
Shall we?
What?
We seem to have approved section 3, which appears on page 6. We have a motion on that.
I move we approve it.
You've heard the motion. Do you wish to discuss it further? Now we call the roll on section 3.
Jeff
Burns.
Aye.
Sander Burns. Aye.
Cross.
Aye.
Chandler.
Here. Aye.
Frost.
Aye.
Haas.
Aye.
Bernstein.
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Knight.
Aye.
Spaulding.
Aye.
Young.
Aye.
I move we approve section 4. Section 4. Is there any further discussion? Not call the roll.
Jeff Burns.
Aye.
Sander Burns.
Aye.
Chandler.
Yes.
Frost.
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Knight.
Aye.
Pauling.
Aye.
Young.
Aye.
Bob, you said that you didn't know these legal Latin terms. You don't even know how to vote.
He's legislative practice.
Section 5, subsection B, is behind managerial leave. Means that officer of the corporation or any other agent in a position of comparable authority.
Could be the attorney for the corporation.
Let's
try that.
Well, what do you do about this nominal officer of the corporation? Is anybody that has comparable authority to a nominal officer of the corporation?
He's a nominal officer and he doesn't have authority with respect to the formulation of policy or supervision.
Bylaws should show that.
Then he wouldn't be a high managerial agent.
The honorary president.
Yeah, he wouldn't be.
Well, I'm not certain. I don't really have a disagreement with this. I'm not certain we aren't imposing liability on, but I think people in the graduate are going to be getting one of the nominal officers anyway.
Well, I think this very clearly excludes nominal officers.
Yeah, it's getting at the guy that runs the corporation, no matter what the hell you call him.
That's right.
That's right.
Well, does the phrase in there. Then this excludes some officers?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Nominal.
I don't read it.
Well, I don't mean officers necessarily. He was talking about nominal employees.
He was talking about
nominal
officer.
Yes.
Means an officer.
Oh, or any other agent
in a position of comparable authority.
Back to both of those things, in a position of comparable authority.
Either of them.
Why don't
you say?
Suppose you've got an employee of the corporation. It's just an employee.
Employed to formulate policy.
Yeah.
Well, he's way down the line.
Well, Lee.
Say, all right, now wait a minute. Hold on.
General.
Well, would you let me just state my example?
Yes, please do.
and he said, well, you can't. I'm not a high managerial agent. So you put in evidence that there is an officer of the corporation, a secretary, who does nothing in the corporation. At all, Doesn't this employee have the same responsibility that an officer does to formulate corporate policy?
Not that we dispose of that kind of Monday we adopt sections.
I see what you mean.
But we what say
his I'm
I don't think so. You've got a lot of corporations in the state where an attorney is the secretary.
But the agency, in a
position of comparable authority.
Bylaws
and practice of the corporation in those cases will demonstrate pretty clearly that the attorney doesn't have anything to do with it except the chief of the annual meeting will send out the notice to the stockholders and solicit proxies and so forth.
Means an officer of the corporation or somebody else who has the same authority. That's what you're saying.
Yes.
But maybe we should have a lot after corporation and after authority.
But you're the janitor, Frank. All right, I approve. You have the same authority as I do because I'm the secretary of the corporation. And therefore, I'm an officer of the corporation. And you have the same amount of authority that I do with respect to the formulation of corporate policy.
More than that, supposing the corporation consisting of three people, you have a million shares and Paulette has a million, and I'm the vice president and I have one share. I never attend any of the directors' meetings or anything else, and yet I am a vice president, and I haven't even attended one. Yet under this, I certainly have a voice because of my position in formulation of corporate policy. Is this intended to cover that situation? And then when you say, or anyone else of comparable authority, a peon that's performing the janitor's functions really has as much authority as I do, as much as I exercise at least.
Well,
I think I got you somewhere around.
I think you may have a point here. I think the bylaws work practice. Show and then he can give an individual case whether the guy actually had the authority or not.
It wouldn't in the illustration that I gave because the bylaws obviously would say that the vice president will perform in the absence of the president with the same functions, etc.
Yeah, then the only thing that he's got to say is the president, I've been vice president for 5 years, the president's never been absent.
I think what they should do is say that in some way that those who actually exercise that authority.
But doesn't that come in 2C?
Yeah,
Does it? Yeah, it does. Because first you're the high managerial agent, but in order to render the corporation guilty, you have to be acting within the scope of your employment and in behalf of the corporation. And if you got one share of stock and don't have any responsibilities,
you can't claim they commanded you or knowingly tolerated you.
You can't be acting in behalf of the corporation.
I think that I back up Lee Johnson.
You lost him, Johnson. Try for another.
That sentence is still bad.
Yeah, it is.
How about letting it read, high managerial agent means an officer of a corporation who exercises authority with respect to the formulation of corporate policy or the supervision in a managerial capacity of subordinate employees or any other agent in a position of comparable authority.
Now that's much better.
I move that amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Will you restate it, please? Mr. Burns.
Do you have it?
All right.
Okay. High managerial agent means an officer of a corporation who exercises authority with respect to the formulation of corporate policy or the supervision in the managerial capacity of subordinate employees or any other agent in a position of comparable authority.
I think that says what Lee Johnson and I wanted to say.
Whatever that is.
I made the motion. You've heard the motion to amend sub B of section 1 of sub 1?
Correct.
Sub B. so that it will read in the manner dictated by Jake. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion carried.
Move
the adoption of 5.
You've heard the motion. Any further discussion? Call the roll. As amended.
The roll.
Not the roll.
Aye.
Sandra Burns.
Aye.
Chandler.
Can we take it?
After
we approve 6, why don't we
take
a
recess?
Aye. Johnson.
Aye.
Knight.
Aye.
Spaulding.
Aye.
Young.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman.
Aye.
I move the adoption of chapter section 6. Maybe we'll do that after the break.
You heard the motion on the adoption of section 6.
What does that mean, 6?
That, yeah.
That new old principle of law.
In behalf of.
That's the one that I think.
Based your feet.
The next debate,
Jack. Publication of our long standing contract. Call roll.
Judge Burns.
Aye.
Sandra
Burns.
Chandler.
Aye.
Want to go back to
Frost.
Do you want to move to amend it?
Haas.
Aye.
Prove it. Johnson.
Aye.
Knight.
Aye.
Pauling.
Aye.
Young.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman.
Aye. Carry. Cook, would you turn back to section 2 before we take a little recess? Is everyone in agreement with section 2 with the exception of sub C, sub 2?
Yeah, I'll move the adoption to sub B.
That opens it for discussion.
Question.
All right, call the roll. Now this motion is on the adoption of section 2 with the exception of sub C of sub 2.
And it isn't necessarily to do away with C. It's
no,
not it, to vote on.
That's right. We'll vote on that separately.
Judge Burns.
Aye.
Senator Burns.
Aye.
Chandler.
Aye.
Ross.
Aye.
Haas.
Aye.
Jernstead.
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Knight.
Aye.
Spaulding.
Aye.
Young.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman.
Aye. Now the gut question. What is your pleasure on sub C of?
I'll move the adoption of sub C.
You've heard the motion. Any further discussion? Call the roll.
It's legal or moral, do we?
Judge Burns?
No.
Sandra Burns?
Aye.
Chandler?
Aye.
Frost?
No.
Haas?
No.
Jernstead?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Knight?
Aye.
Spaulding?
Aye.
Young?
No.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. What's the vote?
6.
6 ayes and 5 noes.
Carry. Let's do this for 10 minutes.
Can we adopt section 1?
Yeah, I think we can adopt section 1.
Well, I don't know.
No,
that's fine.
Call the roll on the adoption of section 1.
Jack Burns.
Aye.
Senator Burns.
Aye.
Chandler.
Aye.
Frost.
Aye.
Haas.
Aye.
Jernstead. Johnson.
Aye.
Knight.
Aye.
Spaulding.
Okay, Don. You or Roger?
No, it's me.
Your name's Barry.
Okay. This article on justification deals really with self-defense, basically. Although there are some sections covering duress and entrapment towards the tail end. Just about everything in there involves some question of self-defense, either defense of yourself or defense of another person or defense of property and defense premises. And we try to say what these concepts are and to establish when you can use force, what circumstances, and further, what kind of force you can use, when you can. We have attempted to codify a great many either common law or case law concepts and put them in statutory form. In other places, we are making some new law. All right, now, Section 1, all it provides is that justification is a defense. Now, the reason it's framed in terms of a defense is that we don't intend here to place the burden of proof on the defendant. And this does not change Oregon law with respect to this. The commentary sets out some Oregon cases. One, a fairly recent case, a 1962 case. There isn't too much law in this area, but it's all quite explicit in Oregon that that it's not up to the defendant to prove self-defense. It's just a question of reasonable doubt. The jury has reasonable doubt. In fact, one case even said that the defendant's entitled to an instruction on self-defense, even though he hasn't raised the issue, if the evidence would cause it to be brought into the case. So we're not planning any change in the law, and I don't think we make any with Section 1. If there are any questions on it, we go on to Section 2. Go to it.
Are we going to go back like we did this time?
We almost have to, because see, this is Sections 2 to 18. We don't know whether we're going to...
Because all the rest of these are just set out some type of justification. Okay, now, Section 2, unless inconsistent with other provisions of this article, and there are other provisions of this article that are pertinent, defining justifiable use of physical force or some other provision of law, conduct which would otherwise constitute an offense is justifiable and not criminal when it is required or authorized by law or by a judicial decree or is performed by a public servant in the reasonable exercise of his official powers, duties, or functions. Now, and then sub 2 just goes on to say what we mean by laws and judicial decrees, including but not limited to laws defining duties and functions of public servants, such as police officers, peace officers, laws defining duties of private citizens to assist public servants in the performance of certain of their functions, such as we have now the statutory duty to assist a police officer in making an arrest and you're requesting to do so. Laws governing the execution of legal process, laws governing the military services and conduct of war, and judgments and orders of courts. So, persons acting within or under any of these would be exempt from criminal liability. In other words, this would be a justification.
That's only to use physical force.
Yes.
To distinguish from deadly.
Right. Now, we don't have a statute covering this present time, but we do have certain specific statutes relating to duties of public servants. And some of those are set out on page 4 of your draft, dealing with mainly with arrest, duties of peace officers, and what they may do in effecting an arrest or in executing a warrant. Also, duties that a peace officer, privileges he has in making an arrest without a warrant. Also, on page 5, you'll see statutes dealing with arrest by private persons, execution of service of a search warrant. We have a statute which prohibits willful refusal by a person from assisting a peace officer. On page 6, a section on justifiable homicide. 163-100. This is one statute.
So he has an attack.
Do you want me to talk louder?
Or faster, or something.
Don, may I ask you, would, in your opinion, with the exception of justifiable homicide, perhaps, would adoption of Section 2 cover all of these statutes that you've covered, or permit the degree of force that they justify?
Yes.
I have a question on Section 2, whenever it's appropriate.
Well, I'm going to handle this. Do you want to go ahead with Section 2 now, or do you want to go on through the others?
What would you prefer?
I think we've got to discuss them as we go. It's not necessarily vote on them.
May not finish it.
Right. This is the time for questions.
Okay, is the term public servant in Section 2, both 2 sub 1 and in 2 sub 2 sub A, are we using the same definition as we did in the bribery article?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Should we make that explicit?
Yes. We should.
Well, it wouldn't hurt. Yeah, it wouldn't hurt too.
In other words, if we are, that's fine. And if we are, it seems to me it would be helpful to say so.
Public servant as defined in such and such section.
Right.
It's also in sub one.
Well, it's in other words.
I think that might help. Further questions?
Is there a difference between physical force and deadly force?
Yeah.
And
yes.
Yes, there is.
So that under this section here, a police officer effecting arrest could not use deadly force.
This doesn't define the circumstances.
No, this just generally states the broad principles. And then when we get to the kinds of force that police officers use, we have a specific section on that.
Now, the term conduct on is defined someplace else about.
It's defined in the culpability.
And same question as to conduct. Should we not use the culpability definition of conduct here?
Perhaps we could accomplish both those by merely amending the commentary.
I think you have a little different question with respect to conduct, because we say conduct which would otherwise constitute an offense. And I think that...
Yeah, conduct is broader in the culpability.
Yeah.
Because this means here activity, doesn't it?
Action.
Action.
Can I ask a question on that public servants? You're referring to the back to the definition in the bribery statute. Can't we confine that to subsection A? We don't want to include candidates.
You've got to protect the candidates.
You know, he has a good point there, though. And I would suggest the same as other statutes.
Well, but above in section one, you're talking about conduct performed by a public servant in the exercise of official power, duty, and function. A candidate presumably wouldn't have any official power, duty, or function during his period of candidacy.
The juror wouldn't be.
I don't look at this paper.
Someone just barbs him and he takes a swing at somebody to get through a crowd.
This doesn't seem to me, that the subsections B and C of that definition, as I recall, really is not. Those are special definitions that were added onto the bribery statute for a particular application there.
D, Marshal, juror.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that those people would never have need to draw upon justification that's written just in.
Well, they probably wouldn't.
The juror is not going to have to perform something, conduct which otherwise would be an offense except he's required to perform it during the course of the jury.
Mm-hmm. Well, perform an agreement that the jury's got to keep order.
I'm sorry I brought it up.
Well, let me say this. Now, the reason I didn't define public servant in here was twofold. Number one, that we're talking in terms of a defense, and that it's going to be up to this defendant to establish that he, number one, is a public servant in any event. He's going to have to show that he is a public servant. And secondly, if you've got a statute dealing with a certain kind of public servant, such as a peace officer, then that statute itself is going to be directed towards a peace officer, so it's clearly going to fall within our definitions here. In other words, I didn't feel that it was necessary to go ahead and define public servant, although, like I said, I don't think it would hurt anything. But
well, the natural inquiry, though, if a question arose, would be, did they mean public servant here to be the same as in the bribery article or different than? And I don't really care, but it seemed to me it would be helpful if we say that, for example, we might say that in the commentary, we might say that generally the definition of the bribery article would apply here, but not necessarily so. Or something like that. I don't care what we say.
Because the most obvious kind of case that you're going to deal with, you're talking about public servants, is not the county clerk or somebody like this, but either the policeman or the fireman
or somebody like that.
Yes.
Not the school teacher.
Commentary on it.
Well, you could put something in the commentary. But in light of this discussion, it doesn't hurt very much to leave it as it is, does it?
No, I don't think so. You might need a broader thing than we can
envision now.
Yeah, and there's nothing to hurt about.
That's right.
Yeah, because if the defendant can establish that he's some kind of public servant, acting in the performance of the duty.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
section 3.
All right, section 3, choice of evil. Unless inconsistent with other provisions of this article defining justifiable use of physical force. And there we get into the question of deadly physical force and this kind of thing. Or with some other provision of law, a conduct which would otherwise constitute an offense is justifiable and not criminal when A, that conduct is necessary as an emergency measure to avoid an imminent public or private injury which reasonably appears about to occur by reason of a situation caused or developed through no fault of the actor. And, B, the threatened injury is of such gravity that according to ordinary standards of intelligence and morality, the desirability and urgency of avoiding the injury clearly outweigh the desirability of avoiding the injury sought to be prevented by the statute defining the offense and issue. That's a real mouthful, I realize. It says that it's okay, for example, for the fireman to chop your door down or to wreck your house if in so doing he can prevent a greater injury such as a conflagration, trying to save the rest of the block from the fire.
It's okay for me to shoot you and wound you and keep you from shooting Tony and killing me.
Or if you have some other crime being committed and you need to call a peace officer in a hurry and you force your way in to get access to a telephone or something like this.
Something that would be very clear to any jury.
Now in the commentary I indicate that examples would be blasting buildings to prevent a major fire from spreading, breaking into an unoccupied rural house in order to make an emergency telephone call, save a person's life, or forcibly restraining a person infected with a highly contagious and dangerous disease. And then subsection 2 goes on, though, to say that you can't pick and choose what laws you think are good and what are bad. And a person, for example, can't claim that a mercy killing should not be viewed as a crime. So that's why we have the language with respect to ordinary standards of. Well, that's under sub 2. That's under sub 2. Not under B. So we have a test under B which tries to weigh the equities here and say that you have to clearly outweigh the desirability of avoiding the injury that the statute says is prohibited. And then under 2, sub 2, that's where that prevents the picking and choosing of your the laws that you think you should obey. Says the necessity and justifiability of conduct under subsection 1 shall not rest upon considerations pertaining only to the morality and advisability of the statute, either in its general application or with respect to its application to a particular class of cases arising under.
Now, if you're talking about the morality and advisability of the statute, is that the one that's violated by the conduct?
Yes.
Don't tell them kind of us about the draft.
Yeah.
If there were state laws.
And because we felt that these are going to be difficult questions to answer under these guidelines, that sub 3 provides that whenever evidence relating to the defense is offered by the defendant, that's under just this section now, the choice of evils, the court, first of all, shall rule as a matter of law whether the claimed facts and the circumstances, if established, would constitute a justification.
Isn't that making the court, when there's a jury, a trier of fact?
We talked about that for a long time.
Yes, we did.
And we decided that while it might be fact, we were going to say it wasn't a fact, so because we'd have to spend too much time, the court could get, we'd never get on with the trial as the court ruled in this case.
Well, I have a question, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
As I read this, I read it to mean that if the defendant says, Your Honor, I have a defense that choice of evils, and I propose to show facts A, B, C, and D, and E, so forth, that the court would then possibly have a voir dire hearing like you do on a confession now, or a lineup problem or something like that, and perhaps make some preliminary findings as to whether or not A, B, C, and D, if the jury find them to be the fact, whether or not they would constitute justification. I'm not sure that's what the section says, but that's the way I understand it. Now, do I understand it correctly?
Yeah, right.
If
established, the words if established, he says to the jury, if you believe those facts, A, B, C, and D, then it is a defense.
But does the defendant merely say, now this is what I propose to show, or does he actually call witnesses like you do in a voir dire hearing on the preliminary question?
You mean in the absence of the jury?
Yeah.
All you'd have to do is say, I propose to show these 4 things, and we'll introduce evidence to that effect. And
the judge might say, well, the hell with you, even if you prove all of those, it's no defense, so forget it.
Well, one of the problems that you run into on that is the facts are elusive, and to perfect a record, I would certainly expect a defendant to say, well, I want to call these witnesses. I want to show exactly what they would establish, so because there might be some inferences to be drawn from those facts and so on that he would want a appellate court to examine, make sure that the trial judge didn't err in saying, well, no, that isn't justification. And the reason I bring this up is it's very nice if it comes up exclusively as a part of the defendant's own witnesses, but very likely you are going to have situations in which it will come up partly as result of cross-examination by the defendant of the prosecution's witnesses. And to have a voir dire hearing on that aspect makes it difficult.
And we talked about that problem in subcommittee, and we have the language here, is offered by the defendant.
Well, he can offer evidence by way of cross-examination as well as by way of the state's witnesses, as well as by way of Well, maybe you can't. I don't know.
Would this be handled any differently than the ordinary offer of proof?
I would take it there would be some cases that would be so clear-cut that the defense lawyer could simply stand and say, Your Honor, we offer to prove A, B, C, and D without even calling witnesses. And the judge would then say, well, either it is or it isn't a defense. If he says it isn't a defense, why, that's the end of it. In other instances, he might very well want to call some witnesses ahead of time. And I want to make sure that in court later on would know, well, this is the, we're going to have a voir dire hearing, or we don't have to, or whatever. Because I can see some real problems.
What if it were couched in the alternative, give the court the discretion to make that determination or to submit it to a jury?
We weren't anticipating requiring a hearing, but at the same time, I don't think we were trying to prevent it if the judge wanted to have a hearing on the case.
The other problem I see is that in the case where the court says it isn't as a matter of law, in justification, do you thereby get into the problem of denial of trial by jury? I can well see that somebody might very well argue this.
He probably would argue it.
And isn't he almost going to have to call his, and say if he just comes out and says, okay, I'm going to present A, B, and C, and D, would I be able to justify it? Or says no. Well, in order to raise that on appeal, he's almost going to have to call his witness.
Oh, I wouldn't think so. I would think that the court could say, you tell me that's all you're going to prove, then we will assume you have proven it. It's no good. Just go on. That is not a justification. And then he could raise that on appeal. But the court has let the record show that he would prove all those things plain.
Well, what I'm thinking about is when the attorney's up there saying, I'm going to prove A, B, C, and D, he's going to be presenting that in the very simplified and best possible light. And so then if the court does deny it,
he goes up on it. Better put a note when she's listening to the tape, she'll go right out of her. Right out of her. No.
On the appeal. And the court says, well, Supreme Court reversed, you got to come back there for a new trial on the question when they actually call the witnesses. It's not the when it gets up there the next time, the Supreme Court will learn these facts. No, I mean, that's not the way the testimony actually came out.
Yeah, I know, but I was against this myself.
You're a hell of a guy to argue.
Well, I'm arguing for it now because we adopted it. As I recall it, I think I had a lot of serious questions about it.
We had extensive discussion about whether we should let the court rule on this as a matter of law.
Yeah, as I recall, I think I...
And the point you raised, Jim, I think, constitutionally, is it a deprivation of trial by jury?
Well, I merely raised that. I can very well see that naming three or four defense lawyers right now that would look at that and start hollering denial of jury trial.
Well, I'm not sure that it isn't.
Within 5 seconds, he got the subcommittee.
It's a similar problem to the court. Admitting a confession, claiming that it was voluntarily given.
It's similar, but you see, in the confession problem, the state has the burden of proving that the confession was voluntary. And all that the Supreme Court has done, in effect, is to say that before we submit that question to the jury, we're going to require a voir dire hearing by the court, kind of establish a prima facie showing of voluntariness. And if it satisfies the judge by then, okay, you go ahead and...
And let the jury decide that same question over it.
Yeah, in the light of the instructions that the confession is involuntary and so forth and so on. Can't be too much and so on. But there, the issue, namely, is the confession voluntary? The issue is submitted to the jury.
Previous meeting.
Even though...
Or the defendant
gives
stuck
it out.
With it, yes.
Yeah. If it doesn't satisfy the court, well, it never gets that. And he's not going to be hung in denial of jury trial on that score.
Yeah, well,
Don, did you do any research on this question of whether or not that's a deprivation of jury trial?
No, I didn't.
Well, we discussed it.
Any more really than the making a ruling on the admissibility of any testimony that the defense offers.
It's materiality.
Yeah.
It's really whether or not this is material, whether it's an issue in this case. The court is simply giving a prior ruling.
The problem is the standard, but there's a broad.
There's a mistake in the minutes.
No, it's not a mistake in the minutes.
I mean, a mistake in the
draft. Paragraph 2.
There is.
A motion was made to insert, quote, is raised before by the defendant, deleting offered.
So it would read, whenever evidence relating to the defense of justification under this section is
raised
by the defendant, the court shall rule as a matter of honor. Page 6 of the minutes of August 15th. And motion unanimously. Mr. Spaulding raised the constitutional question.
Yeah, I thought I did.
And we discussed it.
And rule against it.
What's wrong with just letting it go to the jury under instructions on the statute? What was the reason for having the judge make that determination?
Well, it's to make it clear that the court is going to have to that the defense can't say prolong a trial 2 or 3 days with the so-called justification defense that isn't even a defense.
And they're talking about this thing that's up here in 2, morality. All he's talking about is the morality or advisability of the statute. Mm-hmm. That sort of thing, the court would say, we're not going to waste our time on that. Mm-hmm.
That was the sole reason for it, was to... We felt it had shortened quite a few times. Otherwise, everybody had raised...
There would be a record made of this. They could appeal from the court's ruling just the same as they can now and refusal to under an offer of proof.
But the question...
So,
that tends to be more favorable to the defendant.
Yes, it would.
The question, doesn't the judge have that power without such judgment?
No grounds if it's in the case?
Well... What if there's no objection made? If this is raised by the defendant, I suppose in federal court, certainly the judge would say, well, I won't listen any more of this because that doesn't constitute justification. But I don't know whether Jim Burns would.
Politics.
Yeah, I don't know what Jim Burns
would.
Believe
it anyway.
Yeah. That's right.
Well,
find you to the chair.
Of course.
Have other states done this?
Yes.
And the reason was that
the reason was that because this is such a complicated area, I felt that this would be opening it up to possible misuse of this offense of the choice of evils. Put a buffer in there, the idea was to let the judge rule on it preliminarily.
Well, when the judge rules on it preliminarily, let us say that defendant says, I want to prove A, B, C, and D. And the judge says, okay, that sounds to me like if you establish A, B, C, and D, that would constitute justification. Now, I take it from what you said at this point, or later on, and the court would say to the jury, if you find facts A, B, C, and D to have been established, then I instruct you as a matter of law that such facts would constitute justification and would justify the use of force, and you should acquit the defendant.
Or when the court have to say, unless you find that the state has proven beyond a reasonable doubt that they have not been established.
Yeah, I think you'd have to do it that way. But the point I'm trying to get at is you do not present to the jury the balancing mentioned by 1 sub B. I take it from what's been said, you don't. In other words, the jury isn't going to weigh the, under ordinary standards of intelligence and morality, the desirability of avoiding the threatened injury. Well, this is what I wanted to get at, because then, are you going to instruct the jury in the language of 1 sub B?
I would think so. If the court thinks that the evidence is sufficient to bring that issue in.
Then the jury's question would be, you, ladies and gentlemen, you should decide whether or not the threatened, the desirability of avoiding the threatened injury is so great as to, under ordinary standards of intelligent morality, to outweigh the harm done, then this would be justification.
I would think so, but it's going to be a little damn instructing, and it's going to call for a 4th of July speech by the defendant's counsel.
Yeah. Are there any...
Are
there any of the states that have gone into this provided for a different way to treat or handle this problem?
New York and Michigan are the ones that have this, and they both treat it the same way.
Is there anything in the model penal code?
Yeah. Well, I don't think the model penal code requires this hearing or this rule of law for it.
Oh, all right.
But Michigan and New York both do.
I think I've got another observation about A. I'm hearing what you don't want to see in the
subject. No, go ahead.
I don't remember that we said anything about it before, but on A here, unless it isn't available to the defendant, if the situation was about to occur by reason of a situation caused or developed through no fault of the actor, that simple negligence of the actor brought about some emergency, he cannot rely on his defense.
Yes. Sure, you interpret it that way.
That's what it says.
Yes.
That's what was intended.
Well, it's a negligent act of the actor brings about a chain of circumstances in which some criminal act must be performed
to stop. But
yes,
and I don't think that's right.
The other words, I throw a cigarette out of my car and it catches fire and gone burns the wheat farm and have to run over and bust into his house called the fire.
That's no defense.
I think that's reasonable, but that's the way it is.
Well, suppose you start a fire and negligently start a fire in a building. You try to rescue somebody and you have to clobbing them over the head to pull them out of there.
Well, there wouldn't be much difficulty in that situation. But if a person driving a car in a negligent manner strikes another one, and the fire results, or maybe they have to set fire to another car to extricate the person that's in the car which he struck, or to do some serious damage to it. then if that is the situation, since his negligence initiated this whole thing, this defense would not be available to him.
Well, what we're talking about is the actor doing some horrendous thing that has become necessary. And if that has become necessary, a terrible thing becomes a little bit of a slip on this guy's part. The things aren't comparable at all.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it says.
Yeah, but that isn't what was intended.
No, that isn't what was intended. I didn't think.
Well, now that's something that slipped right over.
I know.
We were so wrapped up on three.
Yeah. Well, the reason I thought of it now, I just happened to have been writing a brief about the the emergency doctrine in the civil case is not available to the guy whose negligence brought about the emergency. And to me, I was trying to argue that that isn't logical because it gets away from the reasonableness of a person's act under these circumstances, no matter what brought it about.
Once he exists.
Yeah, but that's why I thought of that now. I just worked on that a couple of days ago. Mm.
Don?
Now, the way the Model Penal Code handles this, they say when the actor was reckless or negligent in bringing about a situation requiring a choice of harms or evils, or in appraising the necessity of his conduct, the justification afforded by this section is unavailable in the prosecution for any offense for which recklessness or negligence is case may be, suffices to establish culpability.
Well, that's what it does mean, then.
I guess so.
Why didn't you say that earlier?
Why can't I say it better?
Say it again.
The whole thing?
Yeah.
Well, why not say it, what they said there and say recklessness or gross negligence, then?
Oh, God.
That's not
getting
gross negligence.
Well, for one thing wrong with that is that
we don't deny gross negligence in our culpability section.
We use recklessness.
And criminally negligent.
Recklessness is the closest thing we have to gross negligence.
And then we have criminal negligence.
And we have criminal negligence, yeah.
What'd you say? Recklessness. There are situations where a person whose negligent act might give cause to all of this coming about. And then you're not judging him on the question of whether or not he initiated and brought about this whole thing. You're judging him on the steps that he took when this emergency arose, whether it's his fault or not.
Yeah.
And he, at that point, do perform an act that would otherwise be criminal.
Yeah, his original negligence is really immaterial.
So I think perhaps recklessness, if you were to stop there, might be adequate.
Suppose the guy is recklessly driving you. Then I bust in, I grab people against their will, and them out of there to save their lives.
From the fire that you started by recklessly getting them.
But you hurt them in the course of doing this.
Yeah, and I've had to use physical force. Some of them resisted.
This would make you guilty of a crime, and there wouldn't be any defense to
really
say
that. That's right, wouldn't it? How about that end of the table?
Yeah, how about that end of the table?
The live wires.
I just don't think that it is consistent to deprive anybody of that defense because of fault of the actor. Either he's acting properly when he's busting down the building, or he isn't, regardless of how much of fault he was in bringing about that situation.
Unless it's a criminal act.
Unless it's
or
a continuation of a whole criminal act, yeah.
In the first place, it isn't a defense to the original act.
It may be arson.
No,
that's
the... Wouldn't be sure where I'm up here. It's not a defense to the original act. And
no.
It'd be bad.
The original act isn't involved.
Yeah.
If you start the fire and develop into a forest fire, then you've got to burn down the building to backfire against
mm-hmm.
Let me ask another question, Mr. Chairman. We have no present counterpart in existing Oregon law. We agree that the application of this would be somewhat remote. What's the necessity for? We know what it's for, not for the benefit of the corporation.
He's hardly ever going to be prosecuted if he did a valiant act and obviously.
Brown versus United
States. Yeah.
If he's a stranger to this whole situation and he breaks in somebody's house to call the police or the fire department, he's not going to be prosecuted. Ken?
Well,
I
just want to make a comment. It seems to me that the original act would have to be separated from the second act. For instance, if I were doing the driving and I rented the Fairview and I got knocked out in the process and you were a passenger in my car and you went on and did these acts, this something like this would have to be taken into consideration.
It wouldn't have been his name.
But he would be continuing something that I shouldn't have been doing.
This is no defense to the driving. I think some of us kind of thought, well, gee, the guy shouldn't be explicated, but it doesn't affect that original offense. It only affects the latter offense, which is done in the emergency situation. But I think there are emergency situations. There have been prosecutors who say, well, regardless of the morality of this, the law says that I must prosecute.
Where have I heard those words before? Yeah.
What this does to me to recognize and allow instructions on the jury's bargaining power.
Say that again.
What this section does to me is it recognizes and gives the statutory authority for a jury's bargaining power.
Well, it doesn't when you consider Section 3, it gives the court pardoning power.
I don't picture at the close of the defense case the court ruling as a matter of law that this is justifiable and not even sending the case to the jury.
He's ruling whether the claim defense.
Yeah, I mean, the court isn't going to...
No, it's not through then. You still have to instruct them if you find it beyond reasonable doubt.
Well, it's ultimately going to be up to the jury whether they accept this. And then take a situation where his young child is starving, doesn't have work, so he goes out and steals a bottle of milk. Well, rather than to allow his child to starve to death, he's stolen a bottle of milk. So this allows the court to instruct the jury if they find that a child is starving or like that, they can excuse him for his stealing the bottle of milk. In other words, let the jury, what this statute does is allow the jury to say, well, this guy has committed a crime, but really, because of his situation, he shouldn't be convicted of, so we'll find him not guilty.
To avoid imminent or private injury.
Being bound, being.
Lack of the literary today.
Well, then it wouldn't be a defense if he stole that bottle of milk to feed the starving baby if he hadn't looked for work. No fault of the actor.
You know, this is one that I like. How many angels can dance on the head of a pin which engaged the medieval metaphysician? I suspect even St. Thomas got tired at 3:45 and couldn't really count the angels very well. I'm of somewhat of the impression that this section would be used in such rare instances that...
But on the other hand, as the law is written, there is no defense in certain situations to a person committing some acts to avoid the catastrophe.
Yeah, but if a guy broke into a rural home to telephone an emergency message about a fire breaking out or something like that, I think that's one of the illustrations. How many DAs who indicted him would be on the job next year?
even though only 34 of the DAs have discretion in the state, I can't picture any of 36.
Can exercise it properly, I said.
Doing that.
We can assume that most DAs have a heart, but... let me finish, though.
But it isn't always true.
But I don't think it hurts for us to put the heart in the law.
And to give him a legal basis for exercising.
You know, if, as Jim says, this situation will rarely arise, I don't think we'd have a great deal of difficulty with this. If we would just eliminate that sub three, and let it go to the jury in the usual fashion. And then in A, up above, where there's no fault of the actor, make it clear that this is not available to him if he has committed a criminal act which gave rise to this, or perhaps, as far as we want to go, either a criminal act or an act of recklessness. Now, I don't think we'd have much difficulty then with this section. And if it isn't going to arise very frequently, it's not going to prolong the trials over this state, supposing they do take an extra 3 or 4 days to show justification in a rare case that comes up. It doesn't hurt anything.
But then you go back to this stealing the milk situation. He's not looking for a job isn't any crime. So
well, in that situation, it would be available. That defense would be available to him. The jury would have to make the determination.
And I think that when we get this in, and as it becomes better known, it will be used increasingly.
When all else fails.
When you have any other type of a defense or anything else.
The old law school story about arguing about the law means that you argue
some
about
kind
the justice
of a story.
Still, it can come up in too many cases, and if it does arise with such frequency that it interferes with the administration of justice, the legislature's still going to be here, and they'll say, I remember that commission back there, they had subsection 3 on this, maybe we better get to it, too.
Yeah, and counsel for defense aren't going to put up silly situations.
No.
Do nothing about it.
In the first place, I predict very few attorneys in Oregon who would competently draw a requested instruction based upon this section.
Well, there are
and
very
and
few
even, and even fewer
our
judges who
could
promulgate one on their own.
In our sit-in trial, it would have added 3 to 4 days to that trial or more.
All right.
Well, number
because
2 would have taken that off.
No, they claimed that they were very much concerned over the promote this professor. And this was the only way that they could get somebody at the university to listen to them and take some action. And,
yeah, but they can't pick and choose.
Well, but
no, we're allowing them to.
Conduct is an emergency measure to avoid an imminent public or private injury.
Yeah, well, okay, if this private injury to the professor,
we limit them under sub 2.
That's what I'm saying. Shall not rest upon considerations pertaining only to the morality or advisability of the statute.
The question is, without sub 3, the judge can still throw that out. I mean, he just say, I will not, it's irrelevant.
Just as he does today.
Yeah. Because that's what it goes to, is to relevancy material. Yeah. The only thing I was wondering, can I ask one question? Suppose you had a case of a guy that goes out here and beats up a homosexual. Beats him up outside of his house. And he says, I'm going to put up my defense. I was protecting my children. And this is done in a
children are eminently in danger of being attacked by the gun.
Well,
right.
what I'm wondering is it possible under 3 for the judge to keep that testimony out?
Is it possible for the judge under 3 to rule in favor of the homosexual? That's really your question.
It eliminates all of those problems, though. Deletion of that eliminates all of the problems.
Yeah, and I think we honestly put it in our commentaries that we consider that the judge has that authority without this.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's the authority the judge has to rule on materiality and competency of evidence that we were thinking about.
That's right. That's right, and that's what the minutes say.
Yeah, okay. I might raise some commentary from the tentative draft number eight of the model penal code on this question. They say the draft does not attempt to resolve how far the issue raised by the defense should be determined by the court as one of law or submitted to the verdict of the jury. The counsel thought this question best remitted to the law that generally governs the respective functions of the court and jury. The way the ALI is.
Well, that's just what we're saying.
They chicken out too.
Chairman, I'll move. We strike subsection 3. Wait a minute, I want to first move and we strike everything after the strike everything after the word occurred, subsection A, down to the word actor. Strike the words by reasonable situation caused and developed to the fall of the actor.
Well, do you want him to have advantage of this, the benefit of this defense of a criminal act of his that's given rise to these situations? Logically, I think you're right. But
I mean, he's still guilty of that criminal act. He can't use this as a defense.
It could be a little misdemeanor.
What?
A little misdemeanor, and what he's charged with is a felony.
A little misdemeanor. Yeah, but if it is a little misdemeanor, it doesn't make sense to describe him as a defense to a big case.
All right, supposing it's a felony.
All right, suppose
he's guilty of that.
He's guilty of that, and his punishment can be made accordingly by what the result was.
Jordan Valley misdemeanors are damn near felonies.
Oh. No, the guy is recklessly driving and he drives into Fairview.
I think from the standpoint of spend logic.
Some people die, but he still made every attempt to try to get the other people out of there. And in the process, he had to use physical force against them. I don't think he should be accused of a crime as these other people. He's still guilty in the initial crime of manslaughter.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we're going to be consistent with the little bit of business we passed this morning to allow a bad guy who intended to lie to get out and absolve himself of responsibility under the guise of furthering justice is one of the arguments. I think we surely should provide even a bad guy who commits a crime, the actor who starts it, to then reduce the amount of injury by some further subsequent.
It's a good analogy. You've heard the motion. Before we vote, act upon it, I'd like to hear from Don. Does this make sense to you?
Your salary hangs in balance, Don.
Well, I think the Attorney General motion is wrong because of it's a matter of English and a lot of the other stuff, but I think you'd want to move everything after injury. Moved to remove everything after occur down to actor. He really means to move everything after injury.
Yeah, because imminent means the same as
public or private.
Yeah, I'll accept that.
Precedent.
Well, to answer your question, Mr. Chairman, I don't agree with it, but we can certainly live with it in the draft. I mean, the rest of it, it won't be effective from all that much, I don't think, in practice.
Be sure that you get down the Wally Carson analysis. Do you understand the motion? The motion is in sub A to place a semicolon after the word injury in the second line of sub A, and then retain the word and delete the vowel. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
Carried. Did you have a further motion, Mr. Attorney General?
Strike subsection 3.
Sub 3, motion is to delete it. Any further discussion?
That motion includes the earlier discussion that the matter will be dealt with fully.
And commentary, yes.
Well, Mr. Chairman, should be made clear that our action by deleting it isn't to be interpreted by some judge as prohibiting him if he wants in his discretion to have a preliminary hearing to rule on the conflict.
I would say in support of my own motion, move to strike it because this is the inherent power of the judge to,
all right,
to not admit evidence that's not relevant material.
Okay.
You've heard the motion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried. It's 4:07. Shall we quit?
I move we adjourn.
You want to adopt section 3 to give
it a... Yeah, let's adopt it as amended.
Let's adopt 2. We haven't adopted 2.
We haven't adopted 1 or 2 yet.
No.
Well, we can't adopt 1.
I move we adopt 2.
Motion is that section 2 be adopted. Call roll.
And we're going to make an amendment onto it so that we use the same definition of public servant here as we did in the bribery.
So no, say as defined in.
No. We're just going to leave it the way
it is. No, we decided not to leave it, really. I don't
know. All right.
Call the roll.
Judge Burns.
Aye.
Sandra Burns.
Aye.
Carp.
Aye.
Chandler.
Aye.
Cross.
Aye.
Hawes.
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Knight.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Now on section 3 as amended.
I move we adopt it.
Judge Burns.
Aye.
Senator Burns.
Aye.
Carson.
Aye.
Cross.
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Knight.
No.
Spalding.
Aye.
Young.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman.
Aye. We got that knight this time. Meeting adjourned.
I wouldn't.
Bob, you're not the only Lone Ranger.
I wouldn't turn.